Council, if you have not yet done so, please be sure to sign in. And then, once you're ready, we're ready.
Your honors, my name is Jeff Geiger. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Adlin, and I have Zachary McDonald, who's a third-year student at University of Richmond, who's been admitted to argue this case. He's with the pro bono clinic with Harry Carrico, pro bono clinic at the University of Richmond.
Thank you. Welcome. Pleased to have you.
Thank you, Judge.
May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Yes, sir. 2 minutes.
My name is Zach McDonald, alongside co-counsel Jeffrey Geiger. I'm here representing Mr. Cox today on his appeal. On September 15th of last year, Mr. Cox was infamously denied his due process confrontation rights in the parole revocation hearing. The Commonwealth introduced one witness to prove their case, Ms. Dana Mance. Ms. Dana Mance testified to a single report that she signed. That report was 2.5 pages long. It contained the first page and a half of just background legal information on Mr. Cox, and then in the second half, the second page, made faced allegations, and allegations only.
Testimonial hearsay, that's your position, correct?
Yes, Judge.
And that there was no finding of the trial court of a good cause exception for denying the right to confrontation?
Yes, Judge.
Commonwealth has asserted that there's a 5A18 bar, that was not adequately preserved. How do you handle that?
Judge, at trial, defense counsel fully stated their objection. They cited to the court both the Henderson and Melendez-Diaz case, that is the same case as I'm going to be arguing today, and then they discussed with the judge their concerns about the reliability of the report and how the Commonwealth did not have justification compared to Mr. Cox's liberty interests in denying the report, and then proceeded to explain to the court what he would gain out of the cross-examination.
Did Mr. Cox have the responsibility at that time to ask the trial court to make a ruling on good cause?
Judge, I believe that if the trial court had directly responded to defense counsel, he would have had to. He would have had to say, defense counsel, I understand you have concerns about the reliability, but I think the report is reliable. Or I know you're concerned about Mr. Cox's liberty interest, but I think the Commonwealth is justified. The trial court really just sidestepped the objection and said that it was customary to allow it. And in doing so, just didn't address the objection by defense counsel. And that doesn't negate defense counsel's fully stated objection. He was asking the trial court to find that the report was unreliable and that the Commonwealth didn't have justification.
But you didn't ask the judge to make a ruling on that particular point.
Judge, I believe he asked the judge to make a finding that the report isn't reliable. That's the way his objection was formed, was by saying that there are concerns about the reliability of the report, and that considering that Mr. Cox has a significant interest in cross-examining, that the Commonwealth couldn't deny him that. And so if the trial court had responded directly back to defense counsel on that objection, the finding would have been made, but the trial court didn't do that. It's essentially sidestepped the objection. And I think it's telling that we're making basically the same argument in front of this court that was made in the trial court. The test isn't whether or not the judge made intelligent ruling on the issue, it's whether he had an opportunity to do so. And he certainly had that opportunity with the fully stated objection. And I think it's telling that I'm making the same argument to this court today.
Well, I think we can agree that the hearsay objection is out the window. Testimonial hearsay as an evidentiary objection is generally considered to be inapplicable to a probation revocation proceeding. So what we're left with is the due process aspect of confrontation under Morrissey versus Brewer, correct?
Yes, Judge.
And of course that was resolved by the Henderson case here in Virginia, which basically permits a twofold or a dual test, if you will, for admissibility. One, so-called reliability test and the so-called good cause test. So assuming that the record needs to reflect one of those, tell us why that isn't the case here. In other words, what test would you, or how would you have us flesh out Henderson, if you will, to determine, for example, whether or not the hearsay was reliable or unreliable hearsay?
Judge, this is a very new issue. Henderson came out in
2013. I understand. That's why I'm asking the question.
And I think it's pertinent to point to some federal cases. They've had some more opportunity to kind of flesh out this issue. In both United States versus Doswell and United States versus Ferguson, the court kind of explains how these tests work together, how reliability is a critical component, but there also has to be consideration of what's at stake. both for the Commonwealth and for the client. And so in this case, we first need to look at the report and see is it facially reliable.
Are you familiar with the case of United States versus Jones out of the Second Circuit?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar. No.
Okay, well, let me just tell you essentially what the Second Circuit did is come up with a seven-factor analysis to be performed, and while this is the Second Circuit, obviously, and not the law in Virginia, it seems to be instructive, at least to me, and I'd like to comment on it. The seven factors the Second Circuit suggests we look at for guarantees of trustworthiness. The first one would be the detailed, whether the reports, the hearsay reports are detailed as opposed to mere summaries. Second would be affidavits or other hearsay given under oath. Third would be statements by the probationer that directly or circumstantially corroborate the accusations. Fourth would be corroboration of accuser's hearsay by third parties or physical evidence. Fifth would be statements that fall within a well-established exception to the hearsay rule. Sixth would be evidence of substantial similarities between past offenses and the new accusations that bolster the accuser's credibility. And seventh would be a probationer's failure to offer contradictory evidence. Now, it seems to me we have at least arguably, assuming we were to adopt a similar test or analysis, it seems we have perhaps at least three of these seven factors here.
Judge, you don't need to consider whether or not to adopt it. That was the exact same test used in Henderson. And they laid out the seven exact same factors we consider reliability.
Let me ask you, make sure I understand. Basically, on dealing with whether this report's reliable, isn't the information involved basically one probation office, which actually handled the case, I think it was 22 and 28 districts, but Martinsville and in Radford. We have the probation officer who's actually dealing with the man, because he's probably living down in Martinsville, making a report to another probation office. I mean, it's between government agencies that deal with this, and why isn't that almost, because it's, you know, government officers are expected to do what they're supposed to do, reliable. Why isn't that inter-office communication pretty much reliable on its face? Basically, you have, one officer telling that this guy filed up on probation. It's coming out of your court. And when you get to these balancing tests, if we have the probation officers having to run all over the state to come in and basically testify. But why isn't that, it's kind of an inner office. Probation office, we already allow the probation officer to present hearsay. In their report, it's just almost an inner office communication. Why isn't that reliable almost on its face?
Judge, I think the Henderson court answered that question in the very first factor they list. They say that detailed police reports are reliable, but that's opposed
this
to your
summaries. This is a police
report.
This is a report between two probation officers.
Yes, Judge, but the difference between a detailed police report and a summary of that kind of report by a probation officer is the level of detail that's contained. I mean, really, to assess reliability, a trial court needs to know not just what's the allegation, but what are the underlying facts. I mean, essentially, we have a legal conclusion being drawn by somebody. And I'd like to point out that this report was signed by Dana Manns. We don't even know who wrote this report, if it was his probation officer. But even if we were to presume that it was, they essentially reached a legal conclusion. On a certain day, legal conclusion resulted. We have no idea what exactly brought about that conclusion, which is why the court is asking for, in Henderson, something like at least a detailed police report about facts. What did that person actually experience to justify the legal conclusion? And if a probation officer just gives a summary by saying, well, on this day he violated, it doesn't give the court anything.
Well, the report says, in pertinent part, under the violation data, Waylon Cox tested positive for cocaine when he submitted to a urine screen on August 8, 2011. He admitted that he had used cocaine to help deal with the pain from injury sustained in a motorcycle accident. So you've got contained in this report, an admission. And again, going to the Henderson case adopt the Second Circuit's analysis, and I'm not going to dispute that with you, but it seems to me that certainly would weigh in favor of reliability if we're going to use a reliability test now, aren't we? Doesn't
Judge, I would say that we have this probation report that does contain a little bit of information, but what's absent are things like the certificate of analysis. We don't even have anything from a drug testing lab saying that there was anything that resulted in being positive. And while there's a statement being made, we don't know who made that statement to, and we certainly don't know any of the surrounding circumstances.
It's signed by Michelle A. Whitlow, probation and parole officer. Now, she didn't testify, of course, but she's the individual whose name appears at the bottom of this report.
Yes, Judge, we can't be sure who that is. When Ms. Dana Mans was asked on the stand, like, who wrote this report, like, did you write for Thomas Bullock? All she could say was he was being supervised by Martinsville Probation Office. She doesn't even seem to know who put together this report that she signed. And that creates a strong concern that the information is being transmitted in a way that's reliable and accurate. And really what this case boils down to is the Commonwealth denied him his confrontation rights. He has a confrontation right in a parole revocation hearing that can be excused. But unlike any of the other cases that have come before this court, Henderson, Saunders, and so forth, the Commonwealth made no effort.
Well, this appears to be standard type probation report, major violation report. There are a number of them, a couple of them in the record, and they appear to be what amounts to a computer-generated format. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Judge.
And, of course, now I realize we're not talking about pure Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause analysis here, but business records have been expressly exempted from application of the Confrontation Clause. And why wouldn't a major violation report be, in effect, a business record of a probation? That's their job is to supervise these individuals and then make report, either good or bad, on their performance and report back to the circuit court, the sentencing court, as to how they're doing or how they're not doing so well, if you will. So explain to me why the business record exception, assuming we were to able to discern that this was, in fact, a business record, wouldn't solve that problem.
Judge, the reason is because this report was specifically designed to be introduced to court as evidence as testimony. A business record is not something that's made.
Where do you get the evidence of that? Certainly it was. That's the purpose for which it was used. But you assert that it was specifically designed for that purpose. And how do you arrive at that conclusion?
Judge, the report was written under the assumption that it was going to be used in future proceedings and was sent to somebody else under the understanding that it would be used in future proceedings. That's very different from a business record where someone is keeping accounting information, right? When you do that kind of business report, no one is assuming that next week that's going to be transmitted to a judge and they're going to engage in sentencing. But that's what's happening with these reports. Perhaps they're using computer-generated. We don't exactly know what kind of information they put in there. But even if that is the case, they're doing so knowing that this is going to serve as testimony in court that can result in somebody's sentencing. And for that reason, it doesn't fall under business records. It's considered testimonial hearsay, which is why the Confrontation Clause then applies in the due process for probation revocation hearings. And then as well, just like in the United States versus Doswell and Ferguson case, there's more to this than just whether or not the report is reliable. It's the liberty interest that's at stake. Mr. Cox was sentenced to 7 years and 9 months of incarceration. That's a significant period of time. That's a significant liberty interest he has. And the Commonwealth has no excuse for denying the confrontation. They had the opportunity at the trial court to say, well, Judge, we tried to get them here, but they had other things going on today and we couldn't make it. We're really sorry we couldn't provide. They basically said, it's not our job. They said that if the defendant wanted them here, the defendant should subpoena them. That was their answer. But under the Confrontation Clause, it's their responsibility. I see that my time for my main argument is up. If of course any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. Which is all I'll say for a while.
Very well. Thank you, sir. Ms. Darren?
Court, Lydia Dameron for the Commonwealth. Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
The issue in this case can't be decided in a vacuum, and I would like to point out that this defendant was convicted in 2004 of robbery and malicious wounding. He received an active sentence of approximately 5 years, I believe, and the remainder of his sentence was suspended. This was the defendant's third probation violation proceeding. In the prior probation violation proceedings, the defendant had been ordered to get into a treatment program or had been given minimal
revocation. How does whether due process was provided or not depend on basically his criminal record. I don't understand that part of your analysis.
My point being that we don't look at this in a vacuum, and that this folds into this whole concept of what we're now looking at is the reliability test for the admission of probation, revocation, before.
Well, let me ask you about that, Ms. Darren, because it seems to me that's, you know, we don't have, as far as good cause is concerned, we have no explanation for why. So would you agree it's either reliability here or nothing?
Well, I agree with you that while counsel...
I mean, assuming we get past your procedural default argument and get to the merits of it, it's the only test that would be in play here would be reliability.
Yes, I think the reliability test is the test that would have to be.
There's no basis for balancing. It's reliability versus balancing.
Yes, right. I think so. And if that's the case,
then wouldn't it be the Commonwealth's burden at the probation hearing to establish any factors that show reliability?
Well, I think ordinarily there's a preliminary step in that process, and that is, number one, first of all, in this particular case, at the outset of this hearing, the court makes a note and the defendant responds that the report had been received by the defendant and reviewed by the defendant, and there was no statement at the outset of this proceeding that the report itself contained any inaccuracies. And in fact, as you indicated in the report, the defendant had admitted to previously using cocaine, which was the basis for the revocation in this case, along with his failure to pay court costs, which was undisputed. But I would like to jump back to how this issue came up. And the Henderson case came out maybe a year, a little less than a year, before the proceeding, before the probation revocation proceeding in this case. And while defense counsel did cite to the Henderson case, he did not cite to the balancing test or the reliability test discussed in the Henderson case, nor did he...
I'm not sure he's got that burden. I mean, you know, typically all you need to do is to frame an objection and with sufficient specificity to put the trial court on notice as to what your beef is. He mentioned due process. Why isn't that close enough for government work? And then why isn't it the Commonwealth's burden to establish how due process has been properly satisfied?
Because what happened in this case is that defense counsel said, I do have a due process confrontation right, and the court's response simply was that it was customary for reports similar to these from other jurisdictions to come in to evidence in this kind of case. So he overruled the objection, and that's at page 38 of the appendix record.
Well, that's certainly a true statement. I mean, in my experience, that's exactly what happens, but... Prior to Henderson, exactly. Henderson seems to me makes a lot of difference.
Well, at that point, defense counsel had a duty to ask the judge to give the judge an opportunity to make an appropriate ruling, and that would have been to make the second step to say, Judge, under Henderson, you are now required, to make certain findings to show why there's good cause for not allowing confrontation.
But the bottom line, the gravamen of the objection was, I have a right to confrontation here, and that's what the basis is, even if... Maybe he didn't say the magic word, the Henderson case. He did cite Henderson, didn't he?
He did. He absolutely did. We're not quarreling with that point, Your Honor. What we're quarreling with, and what this trial judge was deprived of the opportunity to do because he wasn't apprised of it, was that he had to make this second step, that he had to make these findings to show why confrontation... there was good cause for not allowing.
Actually, that's not true. That's not his. It's true the trial court ultimately would have to make a ruling, but it's the Commonwealth's burden. Once the objection is made, the Commonwealth seems to me has the responsibility to respond and establish for the record how the evidence is admissible.
Well, at the end of the day, Your Honor, the fact of the matter is that this judge was not given an opportunity because the specific objection was not made, that a finding as to on the balancing test was not made, was
Let's assume we don't agree with that. Let's assume we don't agree with your assertion there.
All right.
Tell us how the test has been satisfied based on the record we have before.
Well, what we have here in this case, we have argued that, first of all, there's nothing in the case law that indicates that these probation revocation reports are not admissible. They simply, this test that's been applied here simply establishes some guarantees of reliability or trustworthiness. And I think primarily what the very basic point here is that we have a situation where we've got a report being prepared by a probation officer in the course of their employment. And the law presumes that these government officials do their job and they do it correctly. And that alone gets, when the defendant does not come back and say that there are inaccuracies in the report, or as in this case, the defendant didn't testify and he did.
That sounds a lot like a burden shifting argument to me. I mean, you know, if the Commonwealth has the burden to establish reliability, your argument seems to be it's reliable until the defendant shows it's not.
Well, I think that's absolutely one of the guarantees that the court brings out and it's not all inclusive.
Probation officer is some form of officer of the court. I know the procedures change, but they are actually interviewed and appointed by the courts. Are they actually some form of officer of the court in any, using the term a little more loosely than that?
I think probation officers as lawyers are officers of the court, and we have a duty to perform our jobs responsibly
and honestly. So automatically any statement by a lawyer will satisfy the good cause requirement of
That's a can of worms you don't want
to way to meeting the reliability test.
Well, I was.
It certainly should.
I was struck by your statement, the top of page 14 in your brief, that says, "The record contains no proffer and lacks sufficient information for this court to conduct such an analysis," referring to the good cause analysis, "on appeal for the first time." If that's the case, if the burden is on the government to make that showing, doesn't that mean that reversal is appropriate here?
Well, perhaps I certainly made that statement in the context of the default argument.
518.
And yes, Your Honor. So, but moving on, I do believe that the way I argued that was that given the record such as it is, and of course, this came up in Henderson. And the court sets out this test in Henderson, and they say, well, you know, in that case, the defense didn't ask the court to make the findings. Like this case, it didn't ask the court to make the findings, but since this is a first case scenario, we're going to go ahead and make the analysis.
We
so
know,
they said that there was
right.
no liability in
but
that
we,
case.
We no longer have the excuse that this is the first time out, and so we'll cut some slack and we'll just look at the record. But even if we do look at the record, there's no finding of good cause, there's no discussion of reliability or balancing.
Well, I'd like to go back and point out to the court and look at the specific objection that was made by defense counsel in the trial court as to why the probation report shouldn't come in to evidence, and his objection, his confrontation objection, revolved around the urine test and the chain of custody with regard to the urine test and who took the urine test and under the circumstances that the urine test was taken. So that to me, the objection is one step even further removed from what we've been talking about here.
But Ms. Darin, you know, you've been around a long time, and you know as well as I do that in the real world, in terms of testing evidence, which is what the Confrontation Clause is all about and the right to cross-examine, you know, if the witness who did it isn't there, and you want to, you know, and you want to take issue with the fact that he failed the urine test or that he had a bad urine screening, you can't do it unless you've got the person on the witness stand who, you know, how do you cross-examine another probation officer about how the test was conducted, what was, you know, was it a field test, was it sent off to a lab? None of that, you know, we don't know any of that. And they certainly have a right to test whether or not the allegation that the probation condition was violated, you know, was is factually supported.
I believe if this were a typical confrontation, Sixth Amendment confrontation case, that this argument would be meritorious. But we are in a due process confrontation situation. And in this kind of situation, our position is these reports are given to the defendant prior to the revocation proceeding. He's asked, there's a purpose for asking him whether he's received
the problem, Ms. Darren, and you know, when I wrote the Henderson opinion for our court that later went to the Supreme Court, and the dilemma is, and this is the problem, is that when Morrissey against Brewer was decided, Ohio against Roberts was the law of confrontation. And basically, Ohio against Roberts said, if you satisfy the hearsay rule, you satisfy the confrontation clause. That went out the window in Crawford versus Washington in 2000. We have a whole different now body of jurisprudence developing with respect to the confrontation clause. Morrissey against Brewer has not been disturbed by the United States Supreme Court. So we've got this situation where due process confrontation is analytically different from Sixth Amendment confrontation, and the Supreme Court having remained silent about it. Henderson was an effort by a state court, two state courts, our court and the Supreme Court of Virginia, to try to, you know, arrive at some solution that kind of, you know, marries the two together, perhaps not very successfully. But what we do know is that there is a due process right to confront the witnesses. It's not as strict as the Sixth Amendment confrontation, but it's there. It's a right that a defendant has, and it's not to be lightly, you know, shoved aside.
Our point would be that unless he says that there are inaccuracies, unless he's going to contend that there are inaccuracies in the report.
So it's always admissible by default unless the defendant objects to it.
Well, this is a probation revocation hearing. It's not a trial. It's not a criminal trial.
But that suggests a burden shifting, doesn't it?
Well, I'm not. You can call it burden shifting. I don't know that it is burden shifting, other than, you know, I think other. If you go down the path that he's.
Ms. Darren, the analogy I would use, maybe you can correct me if you don't think this is accurate. Typically, in a trial, you know, if you want to object based on hearsay, it's good enough to stand up and say objection, hearsay. And then the burden shifts to the proponent of the evidence to establish why it's admissible. Either it's not hearsay in the first instance, or it falls within an exception. But that burden is theirs. It's not the burden of the person who objects to say, it's hearsay, and here's why all of the exceptions don't apply. That's which is what you seem to be suggesting should be the case here.
Well, because of the nature of the proceeding in this case, and we have government officials who are presumed to be doing their job correctly and presumed to be following the law, we don't have a situation where the defendant is saying it's incorrect, it's wrong. He just simply wants to test it. And what we cited the Hathaway case, which is unpublished, it's a federal case, but it's under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 32.1, and this issue has percolated a little longer in the federal courts. But the court in that particular case talks about how unduly burdensome it will become to have all of these players.
All you had to do, all the Commonwealth had to do here, was to stand up as an officer of the court and proffer to the court that the probation officer who authored the report was unavailable to testify for whatever reason, or to have the probation officer file an affidavit accompanying the report asserting its truthfulness. That would have satisfied a lot of the prongs of the Henderson test.
All right, may I answer? And let me just say this. The affidavit aspect, that's a red herring. When these reports are prepared, this is not some person off the street writing something on a napkin. This is an official report by a government official. It carries with it an indicia of reliability. Adding subscribed and sworn to is redundant. Second of all, and I've forgotten what I was going to say, golly, is is that I remember now. The probation officer who did testified that this man's being handled lives in some other jurisdiction. And she's here because she's in Pulaski where the original charge and conviction occurred. So we have that chain established by the record in this case, which is why we have argued in our brief, and I see my time is up, but we have argued that the record is adequate for the court to find that the reliability test is met. If not, we ask the court to I'll conclude.
<Ms. Terry. laughs> Rebuttal?
For the first time ever, the Commonwealth is asking this court to excuse their denial of confrontation when they engage in no action to remedy the defect.
Would the remedy that would be available to you in this case, if the problem is that there wasn't a statement that this was reliable made by the judge and it's a requirement and it's not up to you to have a ruling made on that, would the remedy be to remand the case, and then you would have the hearing, and then the judge would make the ruling, and you'd proceed with the revocation hearing?
Yes, Judge. We're not asking the court to make some wave-setting.
You recognize that the court then would be able to make the ruling, and can't do that, they would have time, which I think they offered to do in this case, to continue it if you really wanted to hear and summons up the officer. So it goes back into you now, the court, you agree that the court then gets the right to make the ruling that is missing.
Judge, I think that on remand they would have to have a whole new hearing. And I think that the Commonwealth would then be on notice that they would at least have to provide confrontation or bring something to remedy the defect.
Either explain the or establish reliability or produce the officer for confrontation.
Yes, Judge. We're not trying to change the case law. When Henderson came out, it allowed some lax rules for the Commonwealth to bring stuff in, but it came with a warning that one day it would be taken too far.
Now, of course, in the following Melendez-Diaz, the General Assembly enacted a statute that satisfies the confrontation clause by requiring, upon notice, you either demand the presence of the scientist or you effectively waive it, which is what the law is with regard to the Sixth Amendment in terms of scientific analyses by the lab.
Yes, Judge.
And they could could be a solution here, too, if the General Assembly wanted to adopt a similar
Exactly,
approach.
Judge. And in this case, we don't even have the certificate of analysis. I just want to conclude by saying that we're not trying to change anything. We think under the case law that's current, that it is in violation. And that we ask the court find that his confrontation was denied.
Thank you very much. The court will come down and greet counsel and thereafter take up the case of Hampton versus the Commonwealth.